Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with comments made on Sunday by Justice Amy Coney Barrett after being introduced by Senator Mitch McConnell at the University of Louisville's McConnell Center, who expressed concern that people may see the Supreme Court as a partisan institution, apparently wanting it both ways, since she recently voted in the most partisan way to allow a flagrantly unconstitutional anti-abortion law to become law in Texas. Joining us to discuss the deeply religious one-time clerk to Justice Antonin Scalia, who is behind the Texas law, Jonathan Mitchell, is Lisa Graves, the executive director of the new corporate watchdog group True North Research, who was a deputy assistant attorney general in the Justice Department, chief counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and deputy chief of the Article III Judges Division for the U.S. courts. We will discuss how this anti-union lawyer, who has been praised for the ingenious way he created a law that evades judicial review, was only successful because he had a sympathetic audience on the Supreme Court looking for a way to overturn Roe v. Wade and an eager Texas Fifth Circuit stacked with far-right Trump judges. Then we'll speak with Edward McCaffrey, the Robert C. Packard Trustee Chair in Law and a Professor of Law, Economics, and Political Science at the University of Southern California, about the draft proposal by House Democrats on how to pay for the $3.5 trillion budget reconciliation bill the Biden administration calls the Build Back Better plan. The author of Fair Not Flat, How to Make the Tax System Better and Simpler, and the founder of the People's Tax Page, he joins us to discuss how already the bill, which started at $6 trillion, is likely to be whittled down further and could end up at $2 trillion or less. Then finally, we'll examine the heavily redacted FBI report made public on the 20th anniversary of 9/11, which reveals more of the FBI's investigation into Saudi government officials who helped some of the 9/11 hijackers with money and lodging after claiming chance encounters with them at a restaurant in Los Angeles and a 7-Eleven in Virginia. Ali Alamed, the founder and director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs, who is an expert on Saudi political affairs and Wahhabi Islam, joins us to discuss how there is still much more to be learned about the Saudi role in 9/11 and that the Saudi mindset as a result of Wahhabi indoctrination is at the heart of why 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudis. And before we go to our first guest, now that I have resigned in protest from Pacifica and its Los Angeles station KPFK, we have moved fully to online broadcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where we will be depending upon you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program alive during the critical years ahead in which the fate of American democracy will be decided. For those of you who can, help us keep delivering a daily briefing so that those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate can also join in the fight against disinformation, whether it comes from Mar-a-Lago or Moscow. We must win the political warfare battles underway and fight with weaponized facts to save our democracy as we create a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Lisa Graves, the executive director of the new corporate watchdog group, True North Research. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as deputy assistant attorney general in the Justice Department, as chief counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a deputy chief of the Article III Judges Division for the U.S. courts. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lisa Graves.
Thank you so much, Ian, for having me on.
Well, thanks for joining us. And on Sunday at the University of Louisville's McConnell Center, named after Mitch McConnell, who introduced Amy Coney Barrett, who spoke there and suggested that, I'll quote her, that justices must be hyper-vigilant to make sure they're not letting personal biases creep into their decisions, since judges are peoples too. To say the court's reasoning is flawed is different from saying the court is acting in a partisan manner. I think we need to evaluate what the court is doing on its own terms. So she's clearly expressing concerns that the Supreme Court may be seen as being partisan. It does seem that Amy Coney Barrett wants it both ways. After refusing to block a flagrantly unconstitutional Texas law banning abortions, she turns around and says, oh, we're not partisan. I mean, go figure.
My response to that was cry me a river. The fact that she chose to make those remarks at the McConnell Center, the center that was created by, you know, one of the architects of dark money and the dark money that has polluted American politics, Mitch McConnell, the guy who pushed her through on the eve of the presidential election after blocking Merrick Garland for months when he was nominated during the 2016 election year. And given her own background, she was plainly chosen by Leonard Leo, who's one of the leaders of the Federal Society, to advance his agenda to remake American law to suit their personal ideological agenda. It's rich for her to suggest that we shouldn't judge this court based on the actions taken by judges who were handpicked to basically reverse nearly a century of precedent, of legal precedents that people in this country rely upon, including Roe versus Wade. So she chose the forum to make those remarks. It's almost like trolling to make such a claim at such a center at the behest and with the cooperation and aid of Mitch McConnell, who packed her onto the U.S. Supreme Court and has grotesquely distorted the makeup of that court through his actions. And, you know, she is someone who, in my view, is not fit to be trusted to be a fair and impartial justice on that court. And she wants to complain that people might think she's unfair. Well, that's why she was chosen. She was chosen, in my view, with the precise hope that she will be unfair, that she will have already prejudged these issues, including women's right to choose based on her track record. And she will be eager to overturn it as Leonard Leo and his funders and buddies on the far right request and have insisted upon.
So the New York Times, Lisa Graves, had an article on Sunday, Behind the Texas Abortion Law, a Persevering Conservative Lawyer, which profiled Jonathan Mitchell, who is the lawyer behind this law that was just passed in Texas that the Supreme Court refused to block. He apparently, Mitchell, was a former clerk for Justice Antonin Scalia. He's also been quoted by two of the justices on the court now, Alito and Thomas, all of whom, of course, voted along with Amy Coney Barrett, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh to not to block this law. Is there a connection there in terms, you mentioned Leonard Leo and the Federalists. There, obviously, there's the glue there to some extent is the membership in Opus Dei, which is an ultra-conservative Catholic, some people describe as a cult, but it certainly is not mainstream Catholicism or mainstream religion in this country. So is this person, Mitchell, who the New York Times refers to as being deeply religious and the oldest of seven boys, is he also a part of that conservative kind of Opus Dei crowd?
Well, you know, to be clear, Leonard Leo doesn't have to ask Amy Coney Barrett how she's going to rule. He knows from her track record that she is opposed to Roe, and she was signed on to advertisements attacking Roe and the like. So it's much more of a sort of a wink and nod situation in terms of this man, Jonathan Mitchell, who is purportedly the architect of the Texas law that the Supreme Court recently allowed to go into effect, refused to stay, even though it was plainly unconstitutional and inconsistent with Roe versus Wade. It's quite clear from his actions and some of the things he said that this is his personal view of the law, that he wants Roe to be overruled. He has personal religious views that I suppose compel him in his mind. I don't know what he's thinking at any given moment, obviously, but you have someone who, in my personal opinion, is attempting to impose his own personal religious views as law on other Americans. And I think any American should be concerned when we see someone trying to impose sort of a theocratic view of the world through the law on others. And it's clear that he's part of the Federal Society. He's been active, apparently, at some of its meetings. He's sort of checked all the boxes, clerked for Scalia like Amy Coney Barrett has. He also was a professor at George Mason University, which has been funded by the Kochs for a long time. And the law school there was recently renamed the Antonin Scalia Law School after Scalia died in 2016. He worked with the Hoover Institute. He's attacked labor rights. He's attacked the right to choose. And in this instance, I do have some thoughts about the way he has helped write this Texas law, if you're interested, Ian.
Absolutely. And let me reintroduce you, Lisa Graves is the executive director of the new corporate watchdog group True North Research. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as deputy assistant attorney general in the Justice Department, as chief counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a deputy chief of the Article III Judges Division of the U.S. Courts. And just to follow up on, you mentioned Jonathan Mitchell's anti-labor stance. He actually had a law firm that was his job. That was what the law firm did, which was try to limit the power of unions. And in fact, it was his failure to answer questions when Trump nominated him for some obscure position in the Trump administration. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse tried to get him to answer questions about whether he'd taken money from donors to pursue cases that would help the far right, including his anti-union work. And he certainly didn't satisfy Sheldon Whitehouse in terms of his incomplete answers. So Whitehouse essentially blocked him from that job. But go ahead, just if you could touch on that, and then I want to get your interpretation of what this law that this fellow has written is really all about.
Well, I really appreciate that background, Ian, because the fact that he's, you know, so vehemently anti-labor, anti-workers' rights, that was one of the things he helped orchestrate with this, was the effort that, you know, with the change in the Supreme Court, they were able to change, you know, decades of precedent about the collection of dues for people to prevent free riders, basically people who benefit from labor negotiations from not having to pay any funding to support the negotiations that provide them better salary and better benefits. He actually has sought to make that decision retroactive to try to force unions to pay back dues that were lawfully collected under the constitutional ruling that was in existence for decades. So he's, in my view, certainly an extremist on a number of issues, not just on Roe versus Wade and women's reproductive rights, but also on the rights of workers and on the application of the law. The idea of applying it retroactively is unconventional, to say the least. In this instance, you know, this notion that he's developed this clever technique to get around Roe versus Wade by supposedly empowering private citizens to rat on their neighbors and collect a bounty as private citizens, you know, to accuse anyone who is seeking an abortion or wants to seek an abortion within, you know, 6 weeks or after 6 weeks of the person becoming pregnant. It's a truly outrageous and horrifying law that he has helped write. It's reactionary, radical, and extreme. And I would say it's contrary to, you know, the American experience, except for there is in some ways an analog to it, which is quite horrible in and of itself, which is that back in the aftermath of the Civil War, after Congress passed laws to protect the rights of African Americans, there were states, the southern states were both attacking those newly freed people who'd been enslaved, but also they were allowing the Ku Klux Klan to run rampant in lynching people, in attacking people, in harming people, in robbing people, you know, just the array of things that the Klan was up to at the time. And so Congress passed a law. It was called the Ku Klux Klan Act. And the law was written to basically stop that sort of vigilantism. And what it says is that you can't deprive people, you know, I'm paraphrasing here, but you can't deprive people of their rights either by the state directly or under color of law. So meaning, you know, giving people the authority to deprive other people of their rights. So you can't have the state do it under that, you know, statute, which was codified, you know, in Section 1983 of the United States Code. You can't do it by the state, and you can't just basically allow someone to act under color of law, having, you know, either implicit or explicit legal authority to deprive someone of the exercise of their constitutional rights. And so here you have a right that women have a right to exercise under the Constitution, under Roe v. Wade, this idea that they should be blocked from accessing abortions when they barely even know that they're pregnant is truly astounding and completely contrary to the trimester system of addressing the rights and interests at stake that Roe versus Wade articulated. And then to try to do so by saying it's not the state, it's private individuals, to me, that runs right into the exact same problem that Congress was facing in the aftermath of the Civil War, which was states trying to get or let private citizens do the dirty work that they themselves may not have been doing to deny and repress people's exercise of their rights under the 14th Amendment or other constitutional provisions.
So the point, though, is that this is not so clever, which some people have suggested, that this is a sort of ingenious way to get around judicial review. The point is that it's only successful because of those five ultra-conservative justices on the Supreme Court, Amy Coney Barrett, Kavanaugh, Gorsuch, Alito, and Thomas. I mean, that's how it happened.
It's giving them a hook to be clever in their effort, the effort that many of them have expressly stated that they, you know, intend to overturn Roe v. Wade or wish for its overturn. Or in the case of Brett Kavanaugh, claimed he didn't have an opinion when he plainly does have an opinion and was chosen in part for that opinion. But you have five judges on that Supreme Court who have been put there by the right wing in this country, by right wing politicians, some of whom have basically occupied seats that were in essence stolen from Democratic presidents, presidents who were elected with a majority of the votes in this country. And those judges are willing to act by judicial fiat in the dark of night, as they did over a week ago, and allow this pernicious and outlandish law in Texas to stand for the time being, when clearly it should have been stayed, the case should have been, the law should have been stopped so that there could be briefing about these issues. And he, Jonathan Mitchell and his allies could try to make their case about how this somehow doesn't offend a constitutional guarantee to allow private people to act as vigilantes and get rewarded with bounties for turning in their neighbors or girlfriends or wives if they want to exercise their constitutional right to reproductive autonomy and follow the advice of their own counsel or their doctors about the need for an abortion. It is, in my view, just an absolutely overzealous, outrageous exercise of the law for Texas to pass this. And as you point out, it wouldn't have any effect if you didn't have five judges who have basically captured the court and control the majority, who are willing to allow this terrible law to go into effect.
So just back to Amy Coney Barrett speaking at the University of Louisville's McConnell Center, where she was introduced by Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell, where she made it clear that she's concerned that the public may see the Supreme Court as being partisan. Well, are they worried, these conservative majority who are behind this Texas anti-abortion law, that this might happen, that the public will see them as being what they clearly are, which are political activists in robes, and that this may lead to what's been described as packing the court, even though if you add two more justices, make it 11 to 9, the conservatives would still have a majority.
Well, I think it's unpacking the court at this point, as you imply, Ian. The fact is the court has been packed, and it's been packed with people who were handpicked not because they would be fair, but because in the hope that they would reverse a century of precedent, as Leonard Leo boasted to the Council on National Policy, which was described in an article in The Washington Post in May of 2019, how this architect, the main advisor to Donald Trump, was saying that this court is on the precipice of reversing decades of legal precedents, and that he was, you know, joyful about this, that no one had seen this sort of activity since before the New Deal. And so Amy Coney Barrett is doing some window dressing, in my view, by making this speech. It's absurd, the setting she chose to make it in. And it's also absurd for her to make it, because quite frankly, if she was a person of honor, she would have declined to participate in that sham process, which took place on the eve of the presidential election, and would have allowed that election to go forward, and would have allowed that seat, which arose just weeks before the presidential election, to be filled by a person who was chosen by the president who was elected in that election. But she chose not to, because of her ambition and her desire to, in my view, change the law to suit her own personal interests. She can say, in essence, till she's blue in the face, that we should trust that this court is fair. I don't think we have any reason to have confidence that this majority is fair. We have every reason to believe that they are not fair and that they are determined to reverse our rights.
Well, assuming that progressives and liberals in this country see this whole thing as a wake-up call, and it's pretty clear that the conservatives in this country have had their eye on the prize for decades, and they worked hard behind the scenes, along with Leonard Leo and the Federalists, to come to this position. And they not only have stacked the Supreme Court, they've also stacked the federal judiciary with young, often unqualified activist right-wing judges. So if it's a wake-up call for liberals and progressives that they've got to take the judiciary more seriously, what can they do?
Well, I definitely would refer people to the Actions of Demand Justice. They are working on really alerting people in every state about what's happening with the court and the threat that it poses to people's rights and to settled rights, rights that have been settled for decades, if not longer. And they have a proposal, as you point out, Ian, that would expand the court. I think that it's certainly reasonable to expand the court. There's no reason in the Constitution for it to be nine justices. That's just something that happened over a century ago. And in that time, the United States has grown enormously. The caseload of federal courts has grown enormously. And there's no reason to leave the number of justices at nine. As you point out as well, Ian, the right wing has been focused on the Supreme Court for decades now, since well before the Powell memo, which was issued 50 years ago this past August, in which a guy advising the Chamber of Commerce, who became a Supreme Court justice himself, Lewis Powell, advised the right wing to focus on the courts. And this is exactly what's happened, is this focus. And as a result, in my lifetime, in the past 50 plus years, 16 people nominated by Republican presidents have been put on the Supreme Court. I'm counting Rehnquist twice because he had two different positions. And only four people nominated by Democrats have been confirmed to that Supreme Court. So it's a massive distortion of what's happened to the United States Supreme Court. And the court has veered further and further to the right. And it's absolutely essential that people, in my view, wake up and take action, speak out to demand that the Supreme Court be reformed to look more like America and to be filled with judges who will be fair, who are chosen for their records of fairness, not because they have an agenda to overturn legal precedents that Americans rely upon.
Well, Lisa Graves, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much, Ian. Thanks for having me on.
And again, I've been speaking with Lisa Graves, who's Executive Director of the new corporate watchdog group True North Research. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, as Chief Counsel for Nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a Deputy Chief of the Article III Judges Division for the U.S. Courts. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the draft proposal by House Democrats on how to pay for the $3.5 trillion budget reconciliation bill. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Edward McCaffrey, the Robert C. Packard Trustee Chair in Law and a Professor of Law, Economics, and Political Science at the University of Southern California. He's the author of Fair Not Flat, How to Make the Tax System Better and Simpler, and the founder of the People's Tax Page. Welcome to Background Briefing, Edward McCaffrey.
It's always my pleasure, Ian. Great to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us, Ed. And the House Ways and Means Committee announced today their outlines of how to pay for the $3.5 trillion budget reconciliation bill, the Build Back Better Biden plan, as it's called. But their targets are well below. And it seems like, in general, the Democrats are sort of letting the $3.5 trillion slip through their fingers and are already talking about a much more modest bill. How did it strike you?
Yeah, I think, as always, Ian, you have it exactly right. I think this is the incredible shrinking Build Better Back plan. there's some movie about the incredible shrinking man. So there was time, and we still hear Bernie Sanders, who will keep reminding us of this ancient history by now. There was a time when it was $6 trillion. Then it came down to $3.5 trillion. Meantime, the other infrastructure bill, the genuinely bipartisan infrastructure bill, which was supposed to be $2 trillion, is down to about $564 billion the last I checked. So you're right. I think there was a kind of 100 days moment, a honeymoon moment for President Biden, thinking that he would get us out of COVID, get us out of economic despair, get us out of worldwide infamy and shame, and be the new Roosevelt. Well, less than a year later, things have changed, haven't they? COVID hasn't gone away. Biden's popularity plummeting, fears of inflation and economic uncertainty, and the Democrats are getting gun shy about paying for any kind of Build Back Better plan. And as you led, Ian, it's a $3.5 trillion plan. The first real specific draft of anything, pen to paper version of anything, is this list from the House Ways and Means Committee about how they're going to raise $3.5 trillion. And like the good third grade arithmeticians they are, they're going to raise $3.5 trillion by raising $2.9 trillion. The remaining $600 billion kind of left to an amorphous enforcement pledge. We'll give more money to the IRS and money will rain from heaven, just like it would rain from heaven when the Republicans cut taxes and we would get supply side voodoo economic growth. Now the Democrats are going to scold the IRS and tell them to do what they're supposed to do, and money will rain from heaven. But we're at $2.9 trillion, getting more moderate, getting more modest, getting more old-fashioned Joe Biden-y in its compromise. I would expect it's going to go down further. We'll see some, as we see here today, modest increases on tax rates on the rich, but nothing anywhere close to revolution, certainly not a French revolution, that would usher in a wealth tax or a change to the taxation of gains on death. Nothing structural. Tweak a number up here for ordinary income rate, tweak a number up here for capital gains rates, make very clear that no one under 400,000 could possibly pay a nickel more, and hit the reset button.
Well, the Senator Ron Wyden, who's the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, is clearly not enamored with the House bill. He said today that the nurses, firefighters, and teachers who pay their taxes with everyday paychecks know the system is broken when billionaire heirs never pay tax on billions in stock gains. And of course, he's referring to the fact that the House stripped out any requirement for billionaires to pay taxes on their inheritance. And of course, again, they use the canard of the family farm being at risk. So what explains that fealty amongst so-called moderate Democrats to the super wealthy?
Well, I think it's life as we know it, and as we've known it for centuries. So, actually, as your viewers may know, we've talked before, Ian, when I've been on your background briefings about my tax planning 101, buy, borrow, die, the three-step plan where you just don't have to pay any tax if you're really rich. So you have stock that appreciates without paying dividend, like Tesla stock, like Amazon stock, like Microsoft stock, like Berkshire Hathaway stock. You borrow when you need money to spend, as Elon Musk does and Larry Ellison does, and then you die and everything goes away. So I've been talking about buy, borrow, die for 25 years. It describes the state of American law for the last century. It's been a century in which billionaires, we now have like 700 billionaires in America. It's been a century in which billionaires have not had to pay any tax. And as I told the Democrats who called me for my personal advice, I don't think you change a century of tax policy in a session. I don't think you can reverse course overnight because you've got some good media attention for, you know, some background story on the top 25 wealthiest Americans. So change is hard, change is slow. When you're taxing billionaires for the first time ever, billionaires you know, Elon Musk pays no tax. Donald Trump pays no tax. Jeff Bezos pays no tax. If you're going to try to get them to start paying hundreds of millions of dollars in tax, well, you're going right into the belly of the beast. You're going to hit fierce opposition. The floodgates of campaign contributions are going to open for the Republicans. Moderate Democrats are getting paid now not to raise taxes. If they do raise taxes, Republicans will get paid to do a sweeping takeover and repeal everything that's been done. So I think you see more moderate Democrats like Manchin and Sinema and even moderates in the House, and Democrats worried about getting reelected, not quite as comfortable as Senator Wyden is in the pretty comfortable settings of Oregon. And they're not, I don't think anybody disagrees, anybody on the left, I do not disagree with Senator Wyden. It's outrageous that billionaires pay no tax. Are you going to change that this month? Are you going to change that before the 2022 midterms? I don't think so. So I think actually the House Ways and Means has done the Senate a favor by already beginning to tone down the plan so that when it goes to the Senate and you have Wyden and Sanders on one hand, the left hand, and you have Manchin and Sinema and countless unnamed others on the other hand, the right hand, Democrats don't want to raise taxes. Democrats don't want to do that. They're afraid of the political consequences. And history suggests that, you know, that's a reasonable fear.
And again, I'm speaking with Edwin McCaffrey, who is the Robert C. Packard Trustee Chair in Law and a Professor of Law, Economics and Political Science at the University of Southern California. And he's the author of Fair Not Flat, How to Make the Tax System Better and Simpler, and the founder of the People's Tax Page. But the political considerations that you're talking about, that centrist Democrats on the in the House and Manchin and Sinema and others who were sort of hiding behind Manchin and Sinema amongst the Democratic senators, all of whom have to vote for the reconciliation, otherwise it doesn't happen. It's not as if they're following the tune of the rank and file and the voters out there. The voters out there universally approve of the idea of the rich and corporations paying more taxes. This is a matter of the donors class, isn't it? They're afraid of their donors, not of the American people.
Yeah, I think you're right to be pointing to that, Ian. So there are two things. One is the donor class. And I think the donor class doesn't care about all these social issues that keep getting the Republican base stoked up. They only care about the tax issue, but they're willing to give money, which then ends up supporting the rest of the right-wing causes in order to keep taxes down. So you're absolutely right about that. But on the other hand, I think the story is more complicated about public opinion. So what you keep finding is that large numbers of people favor taxing the rich. You can get large numbers of people to favor taxing anybody other than themselves. So large number of people will say, we should tax the rich more. It's outrageous we don't tax the rich more. But then when you come up with a specific idea about how to tax the rich, like an estate tax, which gets coded as the death tax, which you were right to allude to before, gets swept into a propaganda campaign about losing family farms. Or you talk about a wealth tax and images of the Bastille coming down are going to flood. No, there won't be images of the Bastille because nobody remembers what the Bastille is, but images of French socialists coming to take your 401k will be coming, you know, to a television set or a Facebook page near you soon. So in the last 7 years, I like to point this out when I speak to you and the media and other people out there. In the last 7 years, going back to 1952, marginal income tax rates under the income tax rate, under the federal income tax, the rate has only been raised three times. In the last 70 years, George H.W. Bush, whose quivering lips make him a one-term president. Then it was Bill Clinton in 1992, 1993, and in 1994, that's the biggest midterm loss in over 100 years. The Democrats get pounded. Newt Gingrich comes to power. The Tea Party comes to power. And then Obama-Biden, with the perceived tax increase of Obamacare, They then lose even more seats in the House, and they lose power in 2010. So for the remaining 6 years of the Obama-Biden presidency, it's a split government. So raising tax rates, even if it's only on the rich, even if it's on only on somebody who's not you, raising tax rates, it just plays poorly. I mean, it got us away from the Brits, you know, 250 years ago. And Americans are more than willing to vote out anybody who is perceived as a tax increaser. So the trick, by the way, becomes like raise taxes without looking like you're raising taxes. And that might be a discussion for another day. But the bold face, let's tax billionaires for the first time in history. I don't think we have quite that much courage in our system yet.
So you don't think it's sufficient in calling out Sinema and Manchin, because their arguments seem pretty hollow when they talk about inflation and in particular about raising the deficits, when in fact the whole issue is raising taxes in order to pay for these programs, which won't increase the deficits. I mean, that's where it seems that your suspicion is raised, that they're really out, they're protecting wealthy donors as opposed to having an honest debate.
Oh, 100% right. 100% right. And if you think there's an asymmetry in the dynamic. So right now, the moderate centrist Democrats are getting lots of money not to raise taxes. So it's not just, you're absolutely right, it's not just Manchin and Sinema. I think there are lots of senators who are hiding behind Manchin and Sinema. One thing you see is the plain states Democrats, to the extent such a thing exists, they always come out against any kind of estate taxation or taxation of the rich. So you had Heidi Heitkamp, a former Democratic plain state senator, come out and say she's not in favor of any increase in the estate tax. So there's, you know, Democrats over the last 100 years, Democrats have been in power periodically. They've never used that power to effectively tax billionaires. So that at a minimum suggests it's going to be awful hard to do. And your question, Ian, really, I mean, I think every listener should understand this. This is a bipartisan game. You know, the Republicans get money from wealthy donors to cut their taxes, and Democrats get plenty of money from wealthy donors not to increase their taxes. So, you know, Wall Street billionaires have done very well under Democratic presidencies. And I don't think this is a revolutionary moment. It doesn't feel like a revolutionary moment. It would be a sea change to go from where we are now to actually meaningfully extracting a fair share from the billionaires. It would mean, it would, if we had just everybody pay a flat 20% tax rate, which a lot of your listeners would be thrilled, get rid of all the miscellaneous taxes you pay and just pay a flat 20%, well, Jeffrey Bezos would pay $40 billion that he hasn't paid before. He would write a check for $40 billion. That's not going to happen easily, and it's not going to happen tomorrow.
So what's the fate then, Ed McCaffrey, of the plan to invest nearly $79 billion in IRS tax enforcement to increase revenues, which makes, of course, a lot of sense on the surface?
Sure, sure. I mean, I think what we keep talking about, Ian, and it's such a lovely thing about your program, is we need really deep fundamental structural change. But in the meantime, it's also true that the current tax laws, which have all kinds of holes and loopholes in them and just systematically do not apply to the Elon Musks and the Bill Gateses of the world. But in the meantime, there's a, you know, there's a lot of stuff that gets left on the table because people are just inflating the numbers they put down on tax returns. And the IRS budget has been in a constant state of decline. We're giving the IRS less money as we keep asking it to do more and more things. It's the IRS that's trying to get those stimulus checks out, or the Treasury Department. It's the IRS that's administering the child credit, which is becoming a very important thing to lower income Americans. So the IRS is doing a truckload of things. They're well behind on their automation project. And then their resources to just audit, to just check, look at, double check, what the rich and the well-advised are doing is very, very minimal. So if that ever happens, if the IRS actually gets that money, and if they're allowed to spend it on greater enforcement, sure, there's some more money that could be gotten from, you know, more efficient enforcement of the current laws. No doubt the current politicians are exaggerating how much money that there is there. They're exaggerating the political will to keep the IRS funded and auditing the entire donor class, right? You know, how often do you hear of tax fraud, and it has something to do with someone who's making campaign contributions? So there's a clear link there. So I think, you know, we're realistic people. You and I are, Ian, and it's great to hear talk of better things to come. But when you're talking about taxes, I think you need big, huge buckets of skepticism.
But is it unrealistic to make the argument to the American people that we need to fund childcare, paid leave, pre-K education, community colleges, public health insurance plans, household tax credits, and alternative energy incentives for a green economy?
Yeah, I think that's the basic problem here, you know, and it's a battle between the spending side and the taxing side, and which becomes more salient. And it just turns out that tax card, you know, everybody's in favor, almost everybody is in favor of all of the things you talked about. I think when you get into the climate change, now we're in another political crosshairs, and you're getting flack from the fossil fuel industry. But otherwise, there are not a lot of people standing up and saying we don't need childcare credits, and we don't like little kids, and we don't like education, and our roads and bridges don't need a lot of fixing. If that's the conversation, and I think Biden was hoping that would be the dominant salient image of all of this. But, you know, you and I are here talking about the House Ways and Means Committee, talking about taxing, and there are going to be headlines about taxing. And there's no doubt, as we get into a political season, the ads are going to be about taxing. They're going to be about tax and spend Democrats. That is the best issue for Republicans. That is the best issue for swing voters, for suburban voters, for those independent voters who may be completely aligned with Democrats on all the social issues, but they don't have any money and they don't want their taxes to go up. And they're worried they lost their property tax deduction. They're worried about their taxes increasing. And when they're in the ballot booth, that worry, the worry about paying their mortgage or having enough money to pay for their kids to go to school, that's going to trump concerns, all the list of wonderful causes you just listed. If you're worried about, you're worried about paying your mortgage, you're worried about staying in your house, you're worried about getting your kids to college or paying for your, you know, senior relatives' mental medical bills, I don't think you're that concerned about global warming.
And indeed, middle class and suburban voters tend to vote in greater numbers than the poor and working Americans, who are the beneficiaries of much of what Biden's Build Back Better plan is about. So they're again,
100% right. And yeah, many of those working class Americans who would be economically benefited have been sort of propagandized or made into robots of the right wing. And they're convinced that they have to vote to make America great again, which means perpetuating their, you know, lower economic class existence.
So just in closing then, Ed McCaffrey, what do you think the final $3.5 trillion will be whittled down to?
I think it's going to get lower still. I would say you end up with the number that sounds like $2.5 trillion. That's probably more realistically $2 trillion. I think the revenue side, they'll ultimately be just a wand waved at enforcement, and that will close the gap. So, you know, maybe you see a tax increase on the magnitude of like $1.5 trillion and then make up the gap by talking about enforcement and doing some deficit spending, and you cut back some of the spending plans. So you end up in the twos. You know, Manchin's out there saying 1.5, which is incredibly low. But I would say you end up, You know, and this is also, this is kind of what Biden's been doing. He has been negotiating against himself. So back to some of the details, look at the corporate tax rate. There's a point in time on the campaign trail where Biden says on his first day he will repeal the Trump tax cuts. Well, that would get the corporate tax rate back up to 34. And then when Biden finally proposes anything at all, he says, well, it can be 28, which is a lot lower than 34. And then he has said, and Manchin has said, well, maybe 28 is too high. And now we see a corporate tax rate of 26. That'll come down. We'll get a 24, 25% corporate tax rate. So we're looking at a 3 or 4% increase in the corporate tax rate, a 2.6% increase in the marginal income tax rate for people over 400,000 for the 400,000 plus bracket. These are not earth-shattering changes, but they'll create some numbers, some optics, which will give cover to some more spending programs. And that's, by the way, I think that's what Kamala Harris, who's going to have to come in and cast the tie-breaking vote. She wants to cast a tie-breaking vote for child care and paid parental leave and global warming. She doesn't want to cast. She doesn't want to look like Michael Dukakis in the tank. She doesn't want to get cast as giving a thumbs up to the largest tax increase in American history. So continued whittling down on the tax side, some whittling down on the spending side, and then the bipartisan game of looking for voodoo to close the gap. Here, the voodoo will be enforcement dollars instead of supply side revenue.
Well, Ed McCaffrey, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Always a pleasure, as I said, Ian, and just really much enjoy being your guest.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Edward McCaffrey, the Robert C. Packard Trustee Chair in Law and a Professor of Law, Economics, and Political Science at the University of Southern California. He's the author of Fair Not Flat, How to Make the Tax System Better and Simpler, and the founder of the People's Tax Page. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the heavily redacted FBI report made public on the 20th anniversary of 9/11, which reveals more of the FBI's investigation into Saudi government officials who helped some of the 9/11 hijackers.
Outside the passion, millions put them into power. Expect a little more back for their taxes. Like school books, beds in hospitals, and peace in our bloody time. All they get is old men grinding.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Ali Alamed, who is the founder and director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs and a scholar and expert on Saudi political affairs, including terrorism, Islamic movements, Wahhabi Islam, Saudi political history, Saudi-American relations, and the Al Saud family history. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ali Alamed.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Well, thanks for joining us. And on the 20th anniversary of 9/11 on Saturday, the FBI released its first of what President Biden asked for declassified reports from the FBI's investigation into Saudi activity in terms of what happened on 9/11, or more importantly, what happened before 9/11. And of course, the 16 pages that were released are heavily redacted. What did you learn from it, Ali?
What we learned is this is a new individual who, in the process of attaining American citizenship, was asked questions about his association with a Saudi man who was suspected of supporting the terrorist, two of the terrorists. So the really, this is a summation of information, secondhand information about Mr. Bayoumi and Mr. Basnan in Los Angeles and their activities. So really, this release appears to be just intended on quelling criticism. It's not the real, the beef of the matter. The U.S. continues to shield or to hide from the American people. Obviously, there are thousands of pages of information, and you're talking only about 18 pages about an interview with an individual who second-handedly or who witnessed some issues and meetings between the terrorist and or two of the terrorists and a Saudi official. So, unfortunately, it is disappointing. Like it has been the story of this case for 20 years now. U.S. government has disappointed the American people in the fact that they have not taken the necessary steps to make it clear if Saudi Arabia as a government was involved and what's their the level of involvement.
So as much as we learned about this Saudi consular figure, Bayoumi, who had a ghost employment job at a Saudi aircraft company, and according to the FBI documents, he was treated with great deference at the Saudi consulate, as though he were more important than the consul himself. And the assumption was that he worked for Saudi intelligence. But he did take care of these two hijackers who went, then he found them accommodation in Saudi Arabia and arranged for them to be paid. Some of the money that they were paid actually came from the wife of the Saudi ambassador, Bandar, in Washington. I mean, at the heart of it is that Bayoumi had always insisted that he just ran into these two guys by chance at a restaurant on Venice Boulevard, a Mediterranean restaurant, not far from the King Fahd Mosque. So these guys, by the way, these two hijackers involved in 9/11, they couldn't speak English. They didn't know a damn thing about America. They were just a couple of Saudi guys from the countryside, as far as I can tell. And then they show up later in Virginia, where another Saudi official meets them by chance again in a 7-Eleven and then drives them up to New Jersey. So these are highly stretched the imagination in terms of coincidences.
I mean, the meeting, you know, you can swallow that coincidence because, you know, this is an Arab restaurant. People meet there. This is where people hang. It's not far from the mosque. But taking them to New Jersey, that's something completely inexplainable. You don't take people 5-6 hours by car because you know they happen to be from your country. We do have in our culture the fact that if you meet somebody from your country in a restaurant or something, you invite them to you pay for their lunch or dinner, and everybody insists on that. Each side does that. So, but to give them a ride to New Jersey, that's completely inexplainable, and it does not explain that they are people who you met by coincidence. So I think there is some level of involvement here. However, I think a greater part of the involvement is creating this environment that comes from the textbooks, from the Saudi state religion that has been continued until 2015, basically, supporting elements of Al-Qaeda and ISIS, and continues to have to espouse the same ideas that ISIS is espousing around the world and in its country, where millions of students are learning the same ideas of ISIS and Al-Qaeda. I think this is a greater indictment against the Saudi state, more than so the if a couple of their low-level officials or intelligence officers met by coincidence or by plan of some of the hijackers. So I think, unfortunately, the U.S. government has failed in 20 years to come up with a policy with a policy that actually holds the Saudi state somewhat responsible, by stopping this, the education, the ideas that brought upon not only the September 11 hijackers. People focus on that only. But after September 11, we have seen at least between 5,000 to 10,000 Saudi terrorists who have done very similar actions in the region, in Syria and Iraq, even in Egypt one time, in Yemen, and of course against the people of the country, in Qatif, for example, against the Shia mosques where they blew up themselves, and in Kuwait and other countries. So you are looking at an institution that has created and continues to create terrorists and extremists that targets not only American but other people and other countries.
And Ali Ahmed, back to the FBI's release of the documents, the Encore investigation, as it's called. Some of these interviews, by the way, are as recent as April of 2016. The other character who is very suspicious is the imam of the King Fahd Mosque in Culver City, Thumairy. He also worked with Bayoumi and helped organize the chance meeting between these two hijackers and Bayoumi at the Mediterranean Gourmet restaurant on Venice Boulevard. According to other FBI sources, I take it that at the mosque itself, Thumairy apparently did praise bin Laden, referring to them as our brothers are fighting or something along those lines. So this guy, by the way, he's not just the imam of the King Fahd Mosque in Culver City, which is a Wahhabi mosque. He also is an official with the Saudi consulate. So he's on two payrolls, right?
Yes, Mr. Thumairy was a Saudi diplomat. He was the imam of the mosque. King Fahd Mosque was paid for by the Saudi government and was controlled and maybe continued to be controlled by the Saudi government. And they had a department of Islamic affairs in the embassy, and he was part of that group. I can tell you that Mr. Thumairy is an extremist. I know of a man who worked with him and who told me basically a lot about him. And Mr. Thumairy, when I was very young, we were organizing students to protest here in the United States in the early 90s. And Mr. Thumairy told Bandar bin Sultan, the Saudi ambassador at the time, that we should hire Mexican drug. That's what he said. You know, that's his words. Mexican drug dealers to shoot these people who are protesting outside the Saudi exhibition at the time. So this is the kind of mentality you're dealing with, the person who is willing to carry on killing in the United States. So it was not it's not shocking that he would praise Osama bin Laden. I spoke to, at the time, the Saudi had a university here in the Washington suburb, and I spoke to some of the workers there who are Saudi diplomats, and they said very similar things, that what happened is justified. And I did a couple of reports on it until the FBI decided suddenly to raid it and close it, and it's closed, been closed, and these diplomats deported. But that was the mindset, and that's what I'm telling you, that the mindset that created the 15 hijackers out of the 19 hijackers, that has not been ever addressed by the United States and continued to be ignored. Unfortunately, the policy continued to be to let the Saudis off the hook. And there is a chance, there was a greater chance after September 11 to have Saudi Arabia change from a government of extremism to a better place where the society there is empowered, not only the clan, the Saudi clan that has produced these ideas and these extremist mentality that led to September 11 and the other September 11 that Saudis carried against people in Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Pakistan, Kuwait, and Qatif and other regions in the world. Yeah.
Well, just in closing, Ali Ahmed, of course, talking about the Saudi mindset and the mentality that the Wahhabi indoctrination does, there was a more recent case at an Air Force training base in Pensacola, Florida, where a Saudi trainee assassinated American sailors, I believe they were.
Yes.
And they had to deport about, 10 or 20 of his fellow airmen as well from Saudi Arabia. So the mindset persists after 9/11.
Absolutely. We did a report last year just after the attacks, and we sent it. This is from the Saudi military. This is not even the school books. The school books is one thing, but this is a Saudi military magazine that basically resembles ISIS publication. The way they view other people, other religions, and the justification for hatred and the killing is just mind-boggling. And to me, what the Saudis do maybe is understandable. But what have the American administrations, from the Bush administration until the Biden administration, is I cannot explain it. Why can't they say, this is wrong, we need to address it? They have been avoiding that. And I can tell you, I have very good experience talking to officials, from congressmen to members of Congress to people in the State Department. And the reaction has been always timid. And the word is, we have bigger fish to fry with Saudi Arabia. And I don't know what's bigger than 9/11 and killing 30,000 Americans, but that's apparently the policy and continues to be.
Well, Ali El-Ahmed, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, sir.
And again, I've been speaking with Ali El-Ahmed, who's the founder and director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs and a scholar and expert on Saudi political affairs, including terrorism, Islamic movements, Wahhabi Islam, Saudi political history, Saudi-American relations, and the Al-Saud family history. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. If you missed any of today's program or would like to explore our vast archives, you can find us at backgroundbriefing.org, where we include extended interviews searchable by topic and have made it easy for you to sign up for daily email updates that provide links to resources, articles, and books discussed on the program. Also, you can find links there to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And we also encourage you to rate and review us on those platforms. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media. And please do help us reach more listeners by sharing this program with friends, family, and colleagues. To help us sustain this program into the future and ensure it remains free to all, please take a moment to support us by going to backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where you will find our nonprofit Public Truth Media Foundation, where your tax-deductible donations, large and small, keep us broadcasting now that I have resigned from Pacifica. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing at backgroundbriefing.org. Bye for now. The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared by half.